This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Quiz and Hers, the podcast where we test each other's knowledge and the strength of our relationship in a 10-week battle for glory. My name is Hallie, and I am here with Justin, my husband.
Hello.
Hi. And for those of you who are new to the podcast, the way this works is that each week we take turns asking each other six different questions from six different categories. The categories are times and places, arts and literature, sports and games, movies and TV, music, and everything else. And we talk a little bit about each answer, and all of the questions are tied together, sometimes loosely, with a common theme.
Yes.
I think that just about covers everything.
I have never heard you autopilot that intro quite as hard as you just autopiloted
it. What does that mean?
You're just like, and they're all tied together by a common theme, and the six categories are
When I don't autopilot it and I try to do fun things, you're like, this is getting really off track. I don't know why we're not just going through the basics here.
That's
and
fair.
So I just can't win.
That's fair.
Yes, it is testing the strength of our relationship. Anyway.
All right. So you're up 5-4 on the season right now. It's
right.
Early returns.
We're both doing pretty well.
Yep, pretty good for the start of the season. And today I'm asking you the question so you have a chance to increase that lead.
Yep.
So today's game is called Trivia in the Big City.
Okay.
Because every answer will contain the name of a major U.S. city.
Cool.
There may be other words in some answers. There may not be. The city may or may not actually be related to the meaning of the answer, but it will always be there.
Okay.
All right, here we go. Question number one is times and places. Even though the Treaty of Ghent had been signed almost 3 weeks prior, what final battle of the War of 1812 took place on January 8th, 1815?
I don't know. Baltimore.
You're just guessing my hometown.
It's on your shirt.
That's true. It is. Is that your answer?
Yeah.
No, it is the Battle of New Orleans.
Oh, okay.
Which you must have heard of.
Nope.
Really? That is a classic trivia fact that the last battle of the war happened 18 days after the peace treaty had been signed. And I'll talk about why.
Okay.
But it's really quite fascinating. So I'm going to talk about the War of 1812. Probably the most interesting and trivia useful thing about it is the Battle of New Orleans, but we'll talk about the war overall as well.
Okay.
So the War of 1812 is a weird one, historically. Spoiler alert, it ended in a stalemate. So in that sense, it is almost irrelevant in American history. The British consider it to be a minor part of the Napoleonic Wars, so it isn't very significant across the pond either. On the other hand, it was important to the development of American national identity and the emergence of Canada as a nation. So let's talk about this redheaded stepchild of American military history.
Okay.
The War of 1812 was fought between the United States and the United Kingdom, and each side had several Native American nations allied with them as well. It began, as you may have intuited, in 1812. The U.S. declared war on the U.K. because British press gangs were pressing American merchant sailors into service in the Royal Navy to man ships that were blockading neutral trade to Napoleonic France. So have you heard this term pressing or impressment before?
Nope.
Okay, well you have, because you learned about it in high school, but...
I don't remember anything from high school history.
No, you don't. So, basically, British Royal Navy sailors were allowed, under British law... to essentially, like, kidnap trained sailors from neutral nations if they were trying to trade with France, because they were blockading France. And so American ships that were trying to conduct trade, because America was not involved in the Napoleonic Wars, of course. So American ships that were trying to conduct trade, their sailors, these are merchant ships, not naval vessels, their merchant sailors were basically forced to... work in the Royal Navy, basically as slaves.
Gotcha.
And so the term for it was impressment, and the people who did it were called press gangs.
Okay.
And so while this was legal under British law, you can understand why Americans objected to this practice.
Right.
So this fueled anti-British sentiment in the U.S., and James Madison reluctantly signed a declaration of war in June 1812. The war was opposed by Federalists, especially in New England, where it was derisively known as Mr. Madison's War. That's something that comes up a lot.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, the War of 1812 was Mr. Madison's War. At the time, what is now Canada was still British territories, right? So, you know, when the U.S. declared independence, Canada was still British land.
Right.
So this wasn't about Brits sailing across the Atlantic to fight on American soil. There was some of that, but actually they mostly came down from Canada. Most of the British army was busy in Europe with Napoleon, so the troops in North America mostly fought a defensive war on the western frontier of the U.S. The U.S. suffered early setbacks at the Siege of Detroit and the Battle of Queenstown Heights, but won the famous Battle of Lake Erie, and defeated a confederacy of Native American tribes led by Tecumseh at the Battle of the Thames, where Tecumseh was killed. So, not that Thames, of course.
Right.
So, yeah, Tecumseh was killed at the Battle of the Thames, which is good to know.
Okay.
In 1814, the British very famously burned Washington, D.C., but by this point, both nations were growing weary of war. Napoleon had abdicated his throne in April 1814, so the British had ended the blockade of France and were no longer pressing sailors into service, meaning that the primary cause of the war was no longer at issue. The cessation of trade between the two nations had wreaked havoc on their economies as well. So you can imagine that if you go to war with a major trading partner of yours, that's going to hurt people's wallets.
Right.
Peace negotiations began in August 1814, but the war dragged on. Spain entered the war on the UK side that year, and the Battle of Pensacola resulted in Spain ceding West Florida to the US. The Treaty of Ghent was signed in, well, Ghent, in the Netherlands on December 24th, 1814, so Christmas Eve, which seems appropriate, I guess. But, of course, there were no telephones or internet back then, so it took a while for news of the treaty to cross the Atlantic. That's why the last battle of the war, the Battle of New Orleans, took place on January 8th, 1815, 18 days after the treaty was signed, because nobody knew that the war was over yet. General Andrew Jackson defeated General Sir Edward Pakenham, suffering only 60 casualties to Britain's 2,000. So it was a decisive victory for the U.S. Amusingly, news of this resounding victory reached the major American cities right around the same time as news of the peace treaty. So they were like, hey, holy crap, we routed the British at New Orleans.
Yeah.
Oh, also the war's been over for 3 weeks. Oh, fuck. So, the Treaty of Ghent was ratified by the United States Senate on February 17, 1815, formally ending the war. So as I said, the war ended in a stalemate. The only territorial change was the aforementioned transfer of West Florida from Spain to the United States. So we didn't gain any British territory, the British didn't gain any American territory, there was this minor changing hands of land from Spain, but nothing much. The real losers, in the eyes of many historians, were the Native Americans, most of whom were driven off their lands during the war.
Right.
So, this story basically ended the way most stories in U.S. history do, with Native Americans taking it on the chin. In the U.K., the war was quickly forgotten, and exists only as a footnote in the textbook sections about the Napoleonic Wars.
Wow.
So, basically, in British history textbooks, well, for one thing, they're covering a lot more history than U.S. history textbooks,
because
it's a much older nation, but...
Yep.
But yeah,
imagine, like, I don't know, it's just so much more.
Imagine having to learn, like, 1,200 years of history instead of, like, 250.
Specific.
Yeah, so in British history textbooks, the War of 1812 is basically just mentioned as, oh, and there was this kind of minor offshoot war with the U.S. for a couple years, and, like, that's it. Like, it does not matter.
I feel like in other countries, they don't spend as much time learning about their own country specifically, because, like... It seems like people in other countries know more about us than we know about them, and I feel like part of it's because they probably, rather than having an extra class on British history, probably just, like, do more of everything.
I think they do have special classes in British history, but they also spend more time on world history stuff. And, I mean, in many ways, for several centuries, British history kind of was world history. You know, for better or worse, Britain was the dominant power on the globe for 300 years, so... That might be part of why as well.
Yeah.
Also, all of our, like, game shows and TV and whatever make their way over there, and that's
true.
All American-based. That's probably why they know so much about the U.S.
Yeah.
Anyway, so It's not a big deal in the UK, but in the US, the war was often referred to as the Second War of Independence, and it led to a wave of nationalistic pride. The end of the war kicked off the so-called Era of Good Feelings, which deserves its own discussion one day. And in Canada, defending their lands led to an emerging national identity and contributed to what would eventually become a movement for Canadian independence. So, historians sort of trace Canadian independence to having sort of been born in the War of 1812, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
There you go.
Cool.
All right, question two is music. What eponymous 1976 album included the hit singles More Than a Feeling, Long Time, and Peace of Mind?
I was like, okay, is it going to be Boston or is it going to be Chicago?
Right.
It is Boston.
That is correct.
Justin loves Boston.
The first sentence of my discussion is, I love Boston, the album, and Boston, the band.
Yep, I have nothing, Boston, the city.
I have nothing against Boston, the city.
Oh, I like it.
One of my favorite things about Boston the city is that they are the birthplace of Boston the band, who are named after Boston the city.
I figured.
I'm going to be doing this the whole discussion. Get used to it.
Fun.
Boston the band has had a lot of members since its founding in the early 1960s, but the two to know for trivia purposes are two of the founding members, multi-instrumentalist Tom Scholz and lead vocalist Brad Delp. So that's Tom Scholz, S-C-H-O-L-Z, and Brad Delp, D-E-L-P.
What a name.
Yep.
Sounds like an app.
Delp?
Yep.
He's dead. You're going to feel bad about that in a minute.
Why?
Because you're disrespecting the dead.
I'm sorry.
While Scholz was a student at MIT in Boston, the city, he wrote an instrumental song called Foreplay, which should sound familiar to any Boston fans. Fast forward to 1973, when Scholz and Delp, who had been collaborating for a few years on several unsuccessful projects, put together a demo tape with a couple of other people who do not matter for trivia purposes.
I appreciate you weeding out the...
Yeah, irrelevant. If a member of Boston ever comes up, it's going to be one of these two.
Okay, just like part of flat me, out. Like, part of me feels like I shouldn't leave people out, and the other part of me is like, what will I remember if I include every detail? It's a balance.
Right, and there's been so much turnover, because Boston's been around for decades now, so it's just, it's not useful. So the demo tape included More Than a Feeling, Peace of Mind, and Rock and Roll Band, all of which would become standards for Boston, the band.
They weren't called Boston yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
So the demo tape landed them a record deal, and Scholz played nearly all of the instruments on both the tape and on Boston, the album, released in 1976. So that's when they took their name, was when they released their first album. At the time of the demo tape, they were just like a couple of musicians kind of screwing around trying to get the attention of agents.
Uh-huh.
And they did, and then they named themselves Boston after their hometown.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a funny story about this album. The record label wanted them to record it in a professional studio on the West Coast, but Scholz wanted to record in his basement studio so he could work at his own pace. So Delp went to California with some session musicians, while Scholz stayed back in Boston, the city, and recorded the instrumental tracks. These were mixed together with Delp's vocals, and Boston, the album, was born. So yeah, basically, like, the record label, like, thought they were there recording the album, but basically Scholz was just doing the majority of it, just kind of by himself messing around, and then mixed everything together, which is kind of crazy.
Talented.
Yeah. Aside from the songs I already mentioned, this album included the classic track Foreplay/Long Time, which combined the instrumental track I mentioned earlier with a lengthy rock piece. The album sold 17 million copies in the United States alone. Not bad. And was the first to feature the band's iconic spaceship emblem on its cover. The ship, a guitar-shaped vessel with a clear dome on its top, has been described as a seed ship or colony ship transporting the entire city of Boston to a new world.
I can't picture it.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not as big of a Boston fan as you.
You'd know it if you saw it.
Okay.
Boston, the band, followed up Boston, the album, with Don't Look Back in 1978. In addition to its titular single, Don't Look Back, this album also featured the excellent ballad, A Man I'll Never Be. Scholz felt the album had been rushed and was not happy with the result, but it still sold 7 million copies. He decided that he would never rush an album again. He sure didn't rush the next one. Between a dispute with his record label, some time off for side projects, and founding the music technology company Schultz Research and Development, Boston's next album, Third Stage, did not come out until 1986.
So how many years was that?
8 years.
Whoa.
After Don't Look Back.
Jeez.
Yeah. This album is mainly known for the ballad Amanda, as well as We're Ready and Cool the Engines. Interestingly, Schultz, through his company, developed the Rockman, a guitar amplifier that was later used by artists including Journey, ZZ Top, and Def Leppard.
He seems like a really smart guy.
Yes, he's really smart. He's really good with, like, music technology, and he's really good with playing many, many instruments.
What did he get a degree in from MIT?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Delp departed the band in 1990, but not before co-writing the song Walk On, which became the name of the band's fourth album, released in 1994. Boston, the band, released their Greatest Hits album, appropriately titled Boston Greatest Hits, in 1997. The band's fifth studio album, Corporate America, was released in 2002, and like its predecessor, there is nothing worth knowing about it.
Okay.
It's fine. Tragically, Delp committed suicide by intentional carbon monoxide poisoning on March 9th, 2007.
Jeez.
Delp had still been performing with the band on occasion, and you could argue that Boston, the band, never really recovered. They've toured intermittently since and released their sixth studio album, Life, Love, and Hope, in 2003. They are ostensibly working on their seventh album, but realistically, only their first two albums and Amanda are really worth knowing anything about.
Who's Amanda?
Amanda is the ballad from Third Stage.
No, I know. I thought there was some relevance.
Probably.
You don't know.
I don't know the history of that song, though.
Okay.
It's a good song.
I think I know it.
It's probably the best song on Third Stage, although I do like Cool the Engines. I think many people think that's not a great song, but I like it.
Okay. I don't know. I don't know enough about them.
All right. All right. Question three. Arts and literature. So you have one out of two correct so far.
Yep.
I will be floored if you get this one.
Me too.
All right. Arts and literature. Centrally located. Central is in quotation marks if you couldn't hear it in my voice. Centrally located in the Golden Triangle District and designed by Michael Graves, what public building is an example of postmodern architecture?
And it has the name of a city in it?
That's correct. So this one is sort of a puzzle. I've given you everything you need to piece it together, but it's not going to be easy.
Milwaukee.
Is that your whole answer?
The Milwaukee building. I don't know.
Okay, no. So Central was in quotation marks for a reason. It's the Denver Central Library.
Oh, I didn't know I had to name a whole building.
I told you, the
Jeez.
Building. So
yeah, right.
I gave you everything you needed. Golden Triangle District is an area in Denver. Central was in quotation marks, meaning it's in the answer, and public building basically restricts it to either City Hall or a library, so you could take a shot there.
I have to go make my questions harder, excuse
me. No, you don't. No, you don't, because you've been fucking killing me lately,
I'm
so...
I'm only up by one. I was. I mean, now I'm up by two, but yeah, not for long.
All right. Well, way back in Season 6, Episode 7... I talked about the history of Western architectural movements up to the 20th century. I said I'd do a follow-up discussion one day, and today is that day.
Fun.
So if you go back to that one, this one picks up right where it left off. The revivalist styles of the 19th century looked to the past, and the Beaux-Arts style emphasized ornamentation. So naturally, the first new architectural styles to emerge in the 20th century rejected these principles. The Art Nouveau movement sought to design something new, hence the name, Nouveau, new art,
yeah,
and was characterized by ornamentation inspired by nature that was built directly into the structure. Art Nouveau designs were often asymmetrical, and famous names like Victor Horta and Antoni Gaudí are associated with the movement.
I like Gaudí.
Yeah, so Art Nouveau is kind of cool because, like, there's no distinction in Art Nouveau between decoration and structure. It's not like, you know, if you think of these revivalist styles in the 19th century, like the, you know, the Moorish revival and stuff like this, like all the ornamentation is just kind of like stuck on.
Yeah.
In Art Nouveau, the ornamentation is intrinsic to the design of the building, which is kind of different.
I've been wanting to talk about Gaudí. I should.
He'd be a good one to talk about, yeah. Early modern architecture, on the other hand, eliminated ornamentation. The main principle of this movement was functionalism, captured in a teaching from Lewis Sullivan, Form Follows Function. The design of a building should be solely based on what the building is meant to do. Hence, form follows function. That's the classic summary of this philosophy. The Art Deco style emerged just before World War I, though it did not acquire its name until the International Exhibition of Modern Industrial and Decorative Arts in Paris in 1925. So that's where the term Art Deco comes from, is from the name of that exhibition.
Uh-huh.
Art Deco is characterized by straight lines, geometric forms, reinforced concrete as a building material, and, of course, ornate decorative sculptures apply to the outside of the building.
I like Art Deco.
Yeah.
It's fun.
I think there are better and worse examples of it.
I just like the Chrysler Building.
I find the Chrysler Building to be intensely beautiful. I also find a lot of Art Deco to just be kind of over the top and useless and not like...
Yeah.
Like, there's an understated quality to the Chrysler Building that a lot of Art Deco doesn't have, I think.
I feel like the inside's not understated, but I've never seen it.
No, it's not. I'm talking more the architecture than the design inside, but that's true. No, the inside is very ornate.
I like those tiles and that kind of look.
Yeah. So yeah, notable Art Deco buildings include the Chrysler Building, as we mentioned, the Empire State Building, and Radio City Music Hall, which we've talked about.
I like it.
Yeah, those are the good ones.
I'm trying to think of other ones. I don't think Philly really has any.
No, not really. Well, because Philly's not a big skyscraper town, at least not in that time. There's more of them now, I guess, but they're
I guess Chicago has a little bit.
Yeah, Chicago is kind of unique in its architecture, actually. That's sort of its own discussion. There's a whole Chicago school of architecture, which maybe we'll talk about at some point.
But they also have, like, every style in one city.
Yeah, they do. Well, because Chicago was very much the cradle of skyscrapers.
Right.
And the place where the whole art of building skyscrapers evolved.
Yeah.
So anyway, around the same time as the Art Deco movement, just after World War I, the Expressionist style emerged. Expressionism was all about the use of new materials, like mass-produced brick, steel, and most notably, glass. The forms of Expressionist buildings were often unusual, and it never enjoyed the popularity of Art Deco. Art Deco declined in popularity in the 1930s due to the economic hardships of the Great Depression and intense criticism of its ornate decoration from more functionally minded architects, most notably Le Corbusier, who you've heard of.
Yep.
By the 1940s, disparate early modern styles had consolidated into the International style, which we briefly talked about before when I talked about Mies van der Rohe.
Yeah, I remembered.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago.
That was season one?
I think it was season one. It was Polyhedra.
The Polyhedra episode, yes.
Right?
Yes, the third episode ever I talked about Ludwig Mies van der Rohe in my episode about Polyhedra.
Why was that about Polyhedra? I don't remember.
Because his buildings are just rectangular prisms.
Oh, okay.
That was the joke.
Got it.
So the International style was an austere, modernist approach to architecture characterized by square buildings, minimalist design, and extensive use of glass. Major names associated with the style include Le Corbusier, Walter Gropius, and Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, and to some extent, Frank Lloyd Wright. Though he was so unique that he probably deserves his own discussion one day.
Yeah, that's like plains architecture.
Prairie style, he called it. But he also did some stuff in the International style. He kind of did everything.
He was great.
Yeah.
Wait, what about I Am Pei? That's glass.
So he would be, he's a little bit later than the International style.
Okay.
So the International style is sometimes just called modern architecture, but this term is also used in a broader sense to encompass all architecture since around 1900. For example, critical regionalism is a form of modern architecture that rejects the generic designs of the International style and strives to design buildings that harmonize with their location and give a sense of place and meaning. The most famous example of this is the Sydney Opera House, designed by Jørn Utzon, U-T-Z-O-N, that comes up all the time, and it was designed to evoke the sails of ships in Sydney Harbor. So you can see how that's critical regionalism, right? It's not about kind of a generic boxy building that you could plop into any city.
Yeah.
The Sydney Opera House only makes sense in Sydney Harbor, which is the point. However, the Sydney Opera House is sometimes also considered to be part of a revival of Expressionism in the middle of the century, associated with architects like Eino Saarinen. Another offshoot of Expressionism in the post-World War II era was Brutalism, which showcases bare materials with no ornamentation and utilitarian design. Postmodern architecture began to appear in the 1950s and remains influential today. Postmodernism is about playful experimental designs that mix elements of other movements together and explore new forms for their own sake. The major names to know are Robert Venturi and Frank Gehry.
I knew it!
I knew you were going to say that. I'm surprised you've never talked about Frank Gehry, because I know he's your favorite architect.
He is. I don't know. It's hard to tie things in with architecture. I should, though.
Yeah, he's worth a discussion on his own, I think.
Yeah. I love his stuff.
Yeah. One particularly weird outgrowth of postmodernism is known as deconstructivism, which is characterized by distorted nonlinear shapes, twisted sheets of metal, and a rejection of forms from previous movements. In the early 21st century, new technologies like 3D printing are being adopted into architecture, and issues of sustainability have come to the forefront, sparking young movements like New Urbanism and New Classicism.
Cool.
Yeah, so they actually, a couple years ago, 3D printed a building for the first time.
That's insane. I want to see a video.
Yeah, I didn't have time to look for it, but I mean, how cool is that?
That's cool.
Yeah.
Where's that?
I'm not sure off the top of my head. Probably Chicago, but I'm not sure.
All right. So that brings us to halftime. We would just like to thank you all for listening. We really appreciate it. And, you know, thanks for sticking in there with us. And we can't wait to get back to pub trivia soon,
yep.
Hopefully. If you don't already, please give us a rating and review. You can also like and subscribe. We are on all podcast platforms, and we have Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can find us at Quiz and Hers. You can also send us an email if you would like. We are quizandhers@gmail.com. So please send us some facts or fucks for, I don't think that's a word, but you know.
Facts or non-facts.
Yep. For the Factor Fucked segment, so...
If we ever have to do a PG version of this podcast for some reason, I guess we'll probably just call that Factor Fake.
Yep.
Factor Faked?
Factor Faked, yes.
I like Factor Fucked better.
I know you do.
All right.
But, I don't know, what if we want our kids to listen someday? Bleep.
Yeah, I'll have to go
while
back
they're
and
no,
bleep
while,
everything out.
No, while they're listening with you, you just yell bleep every time.
That would be fun. Anyway. Yeah.
Okay, anyway. So, where was I? We are proud members of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. You can find our merch on bigheadsmedia.com. We have hoodies and t-shirts. And you can also find some other great podcasts there. They have podcasts about a lot of things, most things. So, let's hear from one of those now.
Hey everyone, Chris Williams here, inviting you to join me and my co-host, Perry Seibert, every other Friday for our podcast, We're Watching Here! Every other Friday, we talk movies, from our favorite directors to looks back at vintage releases to our thoughts on today's current trends. This is all backed up with the knowledge of two guys who've been writing about films for years and talking about them their entire lives. From Spielberg to Soderbergh and Malick to Michael Bay, we are opinionated moviegoers giving you opinionated movie talk. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts from Big Heads Media.
And now, on with the show.
Okay, we're back.
All right. So, question 4, movies and TV. The original NCIS takes place in the Washington, D.C. area. What is the title of its first spin-off series, which takes place about 2,500 miles away from D.C.?
God damn it, I thought this was New Orleans. It's the only one I know.
Really?
But you already did New Orleans.
I'll tell you for free, New Orleans was the second spin-off.
Crap.
Oh, man, I thought you'd get this one. I thought this was easy.
I don't know anything about NCIS. I don't think it's Miami, because I think that's CSI. NCIS Los Angeles?
Is that your answer?
It sounds familiar enough. Sure.
Los Angeles is about 2,500 miles away from D.C., and I know because I looked it up when I wrote this question. So,
Yay.
Yes, that's the correct answer.
Whew.
NCIS Los Angeles.
What a relief.
So NCIS is a television franchise consisting of three police procedural action dramas based on the real-life law enforcement agency known as the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. The real NCIS is the primary law enforcement and counterintelligence arm of the United States Department of the Navy, which basically means that they investigate felonies involving U.S. Navy or Marine Corps personnel.
Is it real?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a real law enforcement agency.
Okay.
Which I just said.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I really have to sneeze and it's distracting me.
Are you going to sneeze?
I don't know. It appears not.
Okay. Anyway, so all of the NCIS shows air on CBS. The first show in the franchise was created by Donald P. Belisario and was originally and somewhat redundantly titled Navy NCIS for its first season.
That's like PIN number.
Right, exactly. Navy Naval Criminal Investigative Service is literally what that would mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. This decision was made by the network to avoid confusion with the similar-sounding CSI franchise, which...
Yeah.
Fair enough, I guess.
I confuse them, having not watched either one.
They're very different in that NCIS is okay and CSI is pretty crap.
Okay.
I think.
If you say so.
I haven't watched NCIS in a long time. I watched it a lot in college. Me and my roommate watched a lot of NCIS because it was just always on. Like, whenever we were home and didn't have stuff to do. Yeah. It's pretty good. The title was changed to NCIS Naval Criminal Investigative Service, and eventually shortened to simply NCIS. Interestingly, NCIS is actually a spin-off of the long-running legal drama JAG. The characters were first introduced in two episodes of JAG Season 8, titled Ice Queen and Meltdown, which served as a backdoor pilot for NCIS. You familiar with that term, backdoor pilot? I wasn't.
Yes?
I've
heard of it.
It's like where instead of doing a pilot for a show, you introduce the characters in another show.
Yeah, it's like a spinoff, but not really.
It serves as the pilot episode for the spinoff. Instead of giving it its own pilot, you just cross it over with the
right.
The show it's spinning off of.
Uh-huh.
And that's how you introduce the audience to the characters.
Okay.
So, like, NCIS didn't have a pilot, really. It had this backdoor pilot, which was two episodes of JAG.
Okay.
Okay. NCIS follows the Major Case Response Team, a group of NCIS special agents based in Washington, D.C., though their investigations take them throughout the entire Mid-Atlantic region. The cast is led by veteran actor Mark Harmon as Leroy Jethro Gibbs, a former Marine Corps sniper and the leader of the team, and also one of my favoritely named characters, maybe ever.
It's a good name.
Leroy Jethro Gibbs. Phenomenal.
I like Mark Harmon.
He's great, and he's great in NCIS. Like, he's...
I'm sure.
He's, like, you'd think he would just be kind of this stock military cop type character, but he's actually, like, very complicated and nuanced. He's quite an interesting character.
He's a good actor.
He is. The cast has seen a lot of turnover, but some of the longer tenured members include Pauly Perrette as the goth forensic scientist Abby Shuto.
I can picture her.
She's a great character. Michael Weatherly as Agent Anthony DiNozzo.
Michael Weather, isn't he the one that has his own show?
He's on Bull now. He's right. The lead on Bull on, I guess, also CBS, I think.
So now he's in both?
No, he's not on the show anymore. So, most of these characters are now no longer there. Gibbs is still on the show. Ducky is still on the show. And I think McGee is still on the show. I'm about to mention them. But, like, many of the main characters have turned over just because it's that kind of show. And it's been on for 18 years, you know? Yeah. So there's also David McCallum as Dr. Donald Ducky Mallard. Donald Mallard.
Got it.
Yep, very good. Wow. So he's a medical examiner. And Cote DiPablo plays Ziva David, a former Mossad assassin. She's a great character. NCIS was not immediately popular, but it has consistently ranked in the top 5 most watched shows since its 6th season, and was voted America's favorite TV show in a 2011 Harris poll. At time of recording, it is the second longest running scripted live-action primetime series on U.S. television, behind only Law & Order SVU.
Oh, I was thinking Grey's Anatomy, but...
Oh no. SVU is in its 23rd season, I think?
That's nuts. And I still don't understand how they come up with new things. I know you told me they're like not
they don't.
Totally new, they're just new enough.
And I say this as a devoted fan of SVU.
Who has watched almost every episode.
Almost, yeah. So as a devoted fan of Law & Order SVU, I will say this without hesitation. Half of every season is just generic child abuse and rape episodes, and the other half is just stuff that they stole from things actually happening in the real world.
But you still love it.
I do. It's a really well-executed show. I'm not saying that it breaks new ground every episode. It absolutely doesn't, but I enjoy the characters and I enjoy the storytelling.
I wonder if they're going to do, like, COVID stuff.
They have. I've watched a couple of episodes
already
this season. Yeah, and they show, like, the detectives and the people around them wearing masks and stuff.
That's so weird.
Yeah. So, just as NCIS was introduced via a backdoor pilot, so too were its two spin-offs. First came NCIS Los Angeles, whose main characters were introduced in a two-part season 6 episode of NCIS titled Legend. NCIS Los Angeles takes place in the City of Angels, and the premise is somewhat different than the original show. It follows a team of elite operatives in the Office of Special Projects, a division of NCIS focused on undercover work and counterterrorism operations. The show was inspired, in part, by Miami Vice, which I considered talking about in this game, because it also suits the theme.
Yep.
And like Miami Vice, it focuses on two main characters conducting dangerous undercover operations. The nomadic orphan G. Callen, played by Chris O'Donnell, and thrill-seeker yet devoted family man Sam Hanna, played by LL Cool J.
I just realized how I know this, how I thought of it.
All right.
Because on Sunday nights, there would be football, or afternoons, there would be football on CBS, then NCIS Los Angeles, and then Madam Secretary. So I'd be recording Madam Secretary, and the first half hour would be the rest of NCIS Los Angeles, and I would be super pissed because I couldn't see the whole Madam Secretary.
There you go.
And that would do it. And I would just be like, Chris O'Donnell and LL Cool J.
Yep.
But I remembered that more than I remembered the name of the show.
It's not great.
Okay.
The only other notable cast member is Linda Hunt, who plays the diminutive yet formidable Hetty Lang, Callen and Hannah's boss.
Okay.
She's the one who's like 4 feet tall.
Nope.
You've seen her.
I'm sure I have.
She's in things. She's like 4 feet tall and has a bob cut and like looks like she could just beat the shit out of you.
Okay, if you say so.
Anyway. The cast of the second spinoff, NCIS New Orleans, were introduced in the two-part season 11 episode of NCIS Crescent City, which is, of course, a nickname for New Orleans.
Okay.
Unlike Los Angeles, New Orleans sticks pretty close to the original NCIS concept. It follows a group of NCIS investigators working out of New Orleans, but they investigate crimes from the Mississippi River all the way to the Texas Panhandle. The most notable cast members are Scott Bakula, who plays team leader Dwayne Cassius King Pride. King
That's pretty good.
King is his nickname. Dwayne Cassius Pride, a.k.a. King.
That's almost as good as Mark Harmon's name.
Yeah. It sounds like a boxer, doesn't it?
I love Scott
Dwayne
Bakula.
Cassius Pride, a.k.a. King.
Yeah,
doesn't
that's
that sound
true.
Like a boxer or something? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Incredible. I love Scott Bakula.
Yeah. So he's great. So he's on that show, as is the criminally underappreciated CCH Pounder, who plays medical examiner Loretta Wade.
Who's that?
She's a character actor who is in everything, and she's phenomenal.
Okay.
Liz Shannon Miller and Ben Travers, writing for IndieWire, summed up the NCIS franchise well. It's an awe-inspiring, inescapable presence in the broadcast lineup. NCIS on CBS. It is here. It has always been here. It forever will be. Sounds about right.
Yep.
All right. Question 5 is everything else.
Okay.
So you have 2 correct answers so far?
Yep.
All right. Founded in Georgia just 3 months after the end of the Civil War, what is the oldest historically black institution of higher learning in the southern United States?
Atlanta. Can I just say Atlanta?
I need the whole name of the institution.
Atlanta University.
Is that your answer?
Yep.
It is Atlanta University.
I knew it. No, I didn't.
Well, I gave you the hint and the clue, founded in Georgia, and you knew it had to have a city name in it, so...
Yep.
Yep.
And I'm smart enough to not say, I don't know, Miami.
Well, yeah. I mean...
They think there's just one big city in Georgia.
Savannah, I guess, but yeah. If you had to guess a city in Georgia, you would probably guess Atlanta.
Yeah.
So Atlanta University today is actually known as Clark Atlanta University, however... At the time it was founded as the first HBCU in the southern United States, it was just called Atlanta University, so that is an acceptable answer. I would have also accepted Clark Atlanta, because that's its current name.
Okay.
But yes.
Not that I would know.
No.
I actually have heard of that. I don't know if it was in the news recently.
I don't know. But yeah, you puzzled it out. That's often what trivia is
well, I
making...
couldn't puzzle out Central Denver Library.
Denver Central Library.
That.
So we're going to talk about HBCUs.
That's fun.
Yeah. So, you know, we've talked about this off air that we've both been making a concerted effort to include, like, non-white subjects in this podcast. And I'm finding...
I've been doing a shitty job. I did a good job last season. This season, I've not been trying as much as I should.
So I'm finding more and more that I'm drawn to these kinds of stories about, like, black communities just constructing their own parallel institutions when whites won't let them in, you know? Because, you know, I talked about the Negro Leagues last season, which I thought was really fascinating, that, like, the white Major League Baseball leagues just excluded black players, and so they just kind of threw up their hands and said, fine, fuck it, we'll just go do it ourselves and make our own.
Yeah.
Like, I really find that fascinating and admirable, and I want to say I'm very happy that recently the Negro Leagues were acknowledged as major leagues for record-keeping purposes. I think that's a really good thing. But yeah, that's why I'm interested in this story as well, this story of historically black colleges and universities, because as you'll see, it's basically the same kind of thing. White universities, especially in the South, were excluding black students.
Yep.
And parallel to fighting for integration, they also just established their own educational institutions to serve this need. Instead of waiting around for white people to be better, they just went and did it themselves, which I think is great.
Yeah.
So the term historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, refers to institutions of higher learning that were established to enroll black students prior to the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964.
I actually talked about this a little bit.
When?
I talked about Booker T. Washington.
Yes, you did. That's true. So he was, of course, associated with Tuskegee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm going to talk...
He was involved in that whole movement.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk more about sort of the, like, the broader history of HBCUs, but yes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely related to that one. So, the Civil Rights Act required white colleges and universities to desegregate. But before this law was passed, white institutions, especially in the South, largely excluded black students, so the HBCUs developed to fill this need. A few were founded in the North prior to the Civil War, including Cheney University of Pennsylvania, which is the oldest HBCU, but most of them were founded in the South following the Civil War. The first to be established in the South was Atlanta University, which was founded on September 18, 1865, exactly 3 months after the end of the Civil War. Atlanta University was the first institution in the South to award bachelor's degrees to blacks, and the first institution in the entire country to award graduate degrees to blacks.
Wow.
So, like, the first doctoral degrees and master's degrees ever awarded to black students? Atlanta University.
So prior to that, there were schools in the North that were allowing blacks in for undergraduate.
That's right. So there were a handful of schools primarily oriented towards black students in the North. Most Northern schools were partially integrated, but they had like strict quotas on how many non-white students could be admitted. And so like it was still very difficult for a long time for black students to get into even Northern institutions.
Yeah.
But in the South, most of the schools just flat out didn't allow them. And so that's why most HBCUs are in the South.
Right.
Yeah. Clark College, founded in 1869, was the first four-year liberal arts college to serve black students, and the two merged in 1988 to become Clark Atlanta University. In addition to private universities like Clark Atlanta, many HBCUs are public institutions. In 1862, the federal government passed the Morrill Act, which provided funding for the establishment of land-grant colleges in each state. In the North and West, some of the institutions founded with this money, including our alma mater, Cornell University, were open to blacks, but land-grant colleges in the South, of course, were not.
But I think women weren't allowed in for a while.
At Cornell, they were.
Oh, yeah.
Cornell was always, from its founding, open to any person.
Any person, any study.
That's right.
Good times.
But of course, the land-grant colleges in the South were not admitting blacks, not surprisingly, given the times. This led to the passage of the Second Morrill Act in 1890, also known as the Agricultural College Act of 1890, which required that if a state's land-grant college excluded blacks, the state had to establish a separate land-grant school for black students.
Why didn't they just say they should include them?
Because it was the 1890s, not the 1960s, all I right, guess. Fine. So, many of the public HBCUs in the South were established to comply with this law. So, a lot of them are Morrill-Act land-grant colleges.
Right.
Because the land-grant colleges didn't want to admit blacks, and so they just had to build a completely new college for them.
Which... So, are they state schools?
So, they are, but they're not, like, the state university system,
like
right?
Like Cornell.
That's right. So, like, Cornell is kind of a weird hybrid of private and public university, but... Most land-grant schools are public universities, but they're not part of the main state university system, right? So, like, Texas A&M, for example, is a land-grant school.
Right.
It's not part of the University of Texas system, though.
Right.
So, it's public, but it's not part of UT.
Is it cheap?
I assume there's in-state tuition. I don't know.
I would guess.
But I would imagine so, yeah.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, many Jewish academics fleeing persecution in pre-war Nazi Germany found employment at HBCUs. White colleges in the U.S. had their own more or less blatant anti-Semitic tendencies, and so these scholars couldn't find jobs at those schools. But HBCUs welcomed them as a way of improving their reputations, and out of a genuine belief that higher education should be open to everyone.
Any person, any study.
So, this is a remarkable fact. Between 1933 and 1945, some two-thirds of all faculty hired by HBCUs were Jewish immigrants fleeing Nazi Europe.
That's crazy.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Anyone of note?
No.
Okay. Jeez.
I mean,
it must be someone.
Not like not Einstein or whatever.
I know,
like he was prominent enough that even the anti-Semitic yeah. Ivy League institutions wanted to hire him. You know, like so it's like you know sort
where
of.
Where did he go?
Princeton, I believe.
Of course,
I believe he taught at Princeton.
Naturally.
So anyway, as I mentioned, the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 required white institutions to desegregate. So the percentage of black students graduating from HBCUs has steadily declined since then. So, like, more and more black students are graduating from traditionally white colleges.
Are more white students graduating from HBCUs?
Also that,
okay.
Yes. Interestingly, with the influx of black students to traditionally white universities, the percentage of white students at HBCUs has also gone up, to the point that many of them no longer have majority black student bodies.
Wow.
For example, Bluefield State College in West Virginia has 8% black students as of 2016.
That's crazy.
8%.
Wow.
Others are still like in the high 70s, mid 80s, but some of them are like single digit black enrollment
now. Because
they're
all at like West Virginia.
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting.
HBCUs have always had strong athletic programs, and football is especially important. There are two historically black athletic conferences in NCAA Division I FCS competition, the Mideastern Athletic Conference and the Southwestern Athletic Conference, usually referred to as the MEAC and the SWAC, respectively. Since 2015, the football champions of the two conferences have met in the Celebration Bowl, which is a de facto national championship game of black college football. Traditionally, though, regular season games called classics have been more culturally important than bowl games for HBCU teams. Classics are big events and usually include halftime battles of the bands, tailgates, parade, and other such pomp and circumstance not seen at typical games.
Their bands are fun.
Yeah, the HBCU marching bands are incredible. They're really fun.
Yeah.
Notable HBCU alumni include now Vice President Kamala Harris of Howard University, sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois of Fisk University.
I talked about him.
Briefly, yes, because he had a rivalry with Booker T. Washington.
Yep, that was it.
Director Spike Lee of Morehouse College, and of course, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., also of Morehouse College.
Any football players of note?
Michael Strahan.
Huh.
Went to some HBCU in Texas. I forget what it's called now. It's called Texas... Not Texas A&M, but
well,
something.
Well, he's very famous.
Yeah, I forget what the name of the school is, but it was somewhere in Texas.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right, so you have three correct answers.
Yep.
Here is question 6, sports and games.
Okay.
Of the 13 horses that have won the American Triple Crown of Thoroughbred Racing, only one has a major American city in his name. Name this horse, also the great-great-great-grandsire of fellow Triple Crown winner, Justify.
No.
After all that, you don't have a guess?
No, what am I going to guess? I can't think of a name. I'm trying to see if any city like brings up a name in my head, but I know it's not just the name of a city, so what's
it's
the
not.
Point?
All right. You're declining to answer?
Yes.
All right. It is Seattle Slough.
Nope.
Never heard of Seattle Slough, really?
Nope.
All right. Well, you have now. So as an American, I'm used to thinking of the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness Stakes, and the Belmont Stakes as the Triple Crown. But it turns out that dozens of countries have their own Triple Crowns of thoroughbred racing. That said, I'm going to focus on the American one, which is easily the most trivia relevant. A horse is said to have won the Triple Crown if it wins all three of those races in the same year. All three Triple Crown races are restricted to three-year-old horses, meaning any horse only gets one shot at the crown. The races are open to colts, which are male horses, geldings, which are castrated male horses, and fillies, which are female horses. But in practice, almost all entrants are colts, and although geldings and fillies have occasionally won individual races, all 13 Triple Crown winners have been colts, which that's what you'd want, because then you can breed them and make a ton of money
right.
having them as studs.
Right, if they're castrated, you can't.
Right, so good horses are very rarely castrated, because you want to be able to rent them out as studs, essentially, once they retire. Right. Right, horses usually race for maybe 5 years at most, and then they spend about 10 years just breeding and bringing in money that way.
What a life.
Can't be too bad. You get to eat all the grass you want, you get to bone all the hot lady horses you can handle.
It's like you work hard and then you get your
yeah.
pension or
the
something.
The retirement plan for Triple Crown winners is pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Oh, God, that was gross. All right.
Yep.
So the Kentucky Derby is run the first Saturday in May at Churchill Downs in Louisville, Kentucky, and is nicknamed the Run for the Roses. It covers a distance of 1¼ miles, or 10 furlongs. The winner receives the Kentucky Derby trophy, which makes sense. The Preakness Stakes is run 2 weeks later, the third Saturday in May, at Pimlico Racecourse in Baltimore, Maryland, and is nicknamed the Run for the Black-Eyed Susans, Black-Eyed Susans being the state flower of Maryland. At 1¾ miles, or 9.5 furlongs, the Preakness is the shortest of the Triple Crown legs. The winner receives the Woodlawn Vase. The Belmont Stakes is run 3 weeks after the Preakness at Belmont Park in Elmont, New York.
It's not that far from the city. I mean,
it's on Long Island.
It's nearby.
Yeah. Belmont is the park. Elmont is the town. I don't know why, because it's dumb, but like,
I don't know.
There's no E in,
I've never
in
thought
the town.
Of that.
Yeah, I know. I think
they
Belmont.
Have a casino.
I think That's Belmont like, Park is named after a person. The same person the trophy is, which I'll get to.
Yeah, I guess.
But I don't know why Elmont is Elmont. I don't know.
It just, I think, always has been. It's a coincidence.
I suppose.
I know they have a casino and they have the track and, like, that's about it.
Yeah. The Belmont is nicknamed the Test of the Champion. At 1½ miles, or 12 furlongs, it is the longest of the three races. This makes it more a test of endurance than the other two, and occasional criticism has been directed at the unfair advantage that fresh horses who did not run in the Derby or the Preakness have in the race. So if you want to win the Belmont, if that's your goal, you can skip the Derby and the Preakness and your horse will have a massive advantage.
Just to, like, mess up the Triple Crown runnings?
Well, that's exactly it. So
that's
when
so
a horse wins 2 out of 3, it is most commonly the Derby and the Preakness.
Right.
And then if they lose, they often lose to a fresh horse. And this was like a source of controversy in the thoroughbred racing community because, as we'll see, there was a huge gap almost 30 years before American Pharoah won in 2015. And people were saying, like, there's never going to be another Triple Crown winner because all these people are gaming the system by putting fresh horses into the Belmont to fuck up the Triple Crown, basically.
He was that good.
American Pharoah was
that
good. But
also, maybe you should just have to do all three. Maybe it should just be that has to do all three.
So that's the thing. Horse racing isn't governed in the way that, like, a team sport is. So, like, you pay an entry fee to get your horse in the race. And so it is at your discretion as an owner what races your horse runs in.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. So the winner of the Belmont receives the August Belmont Trophy. And I can only assume that the Belmont Stakes are named for August Belmont. So, of the 4,224 horses who have entered one or more of the races, only 13 have successfully won the Triple Crown. The first winner was Sir Barton in 1919. So that's the first one, Sir Barton. That's good to know. Gallant Fox won in 1930, and his son Omaha won in 1935, making their trainer James E. Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons the first man to train multiple Triple Crown winners.
That's cool.
Sonny Jim.
Sonny Jim.
Fitzsimmons, yep.
Okay.
Gallant Fox and Omaha remain the only father-son pair to each win the crown.
That's fun.
Yeah, it's cool,
Omaha,
right?
Omaha didn't make his own.
No, Omaha. None of Omaha's spawn have won the Triple Crown.
Oh, well.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, some of the other ones were distantly related to him, but that's the thing. You get turnover every, like, 5 years in terms of horse generations, you know? Following Omaha's win, there was a string of winners. The legendary War Admiral won in 1937, Whirlaway won in 1941, Count Fleet in 1943, Assault in 1946.
Assault?
Assault.
That's a horrible name.
I guess. And Citation in 1948.
That's a good name.
Citation's a good name, I agree. Following this, though, there was no Triple Crown winner for 25 years until Secretariat achieved the feat in 1973.
I've heard of Secretariat.
Yes, you have. Secretariat is probably the greatest horse in the history of the Triple Crown. To this day, he holds the record for fastest finish in all three races. Still, like 40 years later.
Wow.
50 years later, almost.
Yep.
Nobody has beaten Secretariat's time in any of these three races.
Wow.
Seattle Slew won in 1977, and Affirmed won in 1978. Affirmed's jockey, Steve Kaufman, is the youngest to ever win the Triple Crown. He was just 18 years old when he accomplished it.
Wow.
So that's remarkable. Following that, though, came the longest drought in Triple Crown history. No horse would pull it off again until American Pharoah in 2015.
Wait, when was Seattle Slew?
1977, and then Affirmed was 1978.
Oh, sorry.
So back-to-back, 77, 78,
got
and
it.
Then nobody did it until 2015, until American Pharoah, which spelled
Pharoah.
You
were very
wrong.
Excited.
I was losing my shit watching the Belmont. I was so excited that I finally got to see a Triple Crown winner.
Yep.
Worth noting, American Pharoah is spelled wrong. It's spelled P-H-A-R-O-A-H, whereas Pharoah is properly spelled P-H-A-R-A-O-H. So it's spelled the way it sounds like it should be spelled, but not the way it actually is.
But like when you look at it, it looks wrong, but then you're like, but it sounds right, but it looks
That's right.
wrong.
It's spelled the way the word actually sounds.
Right, but then you're like, it just looks wrong.
Yeah, it does. American Pharoah also won the very prestigious Breeders' Cup that year. The Breeders' Cup was not established until 1984, so American Pharoah remains the only horse to have won all four races, a feat that is now referred to as the Grand Slam of thoroughbred racing.
Cool.
So he's the only Grand Slam winner, American Pharoah.
Nice.
The most recent Triple Crown winner was Justify in 2018. American Pharoah and Justify were both trained by Bob Baffert, making him only the second trainer ever to win two Triple Crowns, following Sonny Jim.
Yep.
And Justify's jockey Mike Smith is the oldest to win the crown at 52 years old. You remember that? When we watched him win the Belmont?
Yeah.
And he was like...
Old.
He's old.
Not he's, old, but...
He's 52, yeah. for God's sake. Yeah. Not surprisingly, the COVID-19 pandemic fucked up scheduling the races this year. They did all happen, but way out of order, and a different horse won each race. So maybe we'll have another Triple Crown winner next year. We'll see.
Cool.
Yeah, so there you go. I've been wanting to do that forever, and I finally found the right theme.
And it comes soon after I talked about horse racing.
That's right, yeah. So I finally found the right theme to talk about the Triple Crown, so there you go.
Cool.
Hey everyone, we will be back to our regularly scheduled episode of Quizzin' Hers in just one moment, but first we want to take a moment to recommend another great trivia podcast we think you might enjoy. If you're liking what we're doing here, you should check out the Brain Ladle podcast. That's Brain, L-A-D-L-E, because I can never remember how to spell that kitchen tool. They are just a bunch of guys who quiz each other every week. Every quiz has a theme, sort of like ours, but they do 24 questions and a 10-answer final bonus round at the end, so... A lot more questions and a lot less dicking around than on our show. So
less talking, more questioning.
Correct, yes. But it's a real fun show, and if you enjoy what we're doing here, definitely go check them out on wherever you get your podcasts. That's Brain Ladle Podcast.
Enjoy. Okay, that brings us to our segment, Fact or Fucked. And this one comes from Brain Ladle Productions, which we mentioned them, and they're great, and also great trivia, and you can find them on Twitter, at Ladle Brain, L-A-D-L-E Brain.
Yep, or you can just find them wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Also that. Okay. They said, sperm whales can produce clicks as loud as 230 decibels, 90 decibels louder than a jet engine at 100 feet.
Wow. I know sperm whales are very loud, but I can't imagine they're 90 decibels louder than a fucking jet engine. I think they're trying to trap us with the extremity of the claim. I'm going to say fucked. They're probably like as loud as a jet engine or something.
No, it's true.
Holy shit.
Yep.
That's crazy.
Yep. Can you speak whale? Good job.
That's factor fucked in blue whale. I don't speak sperm whale.
Oh, okay. Sorry. My apologies. All right. I guess that's it then.
That got weird.
Yep. It was a stupid reference to Finding Nemo, which you hate, so.
I do hate that movie, and I didn't get the reference.
Of course you didn't.
Okay.
All right. We will see you next week.
All right. See you guys then.
Bye.
Bye. Interestingly, NCIS is actually a spin-off of the Wrong Lunning.
I heard Wrong Lunning.
Wrong Lunning? The Wrong Lunning. Yep. Yeah. Oh, good God.